The Spokane and Inland Empire Railroad began as a Spokane streetcar line, used largely for real estate development, and grew into a regional electric railway, noted for its cutting-edge technology and elegant sense of style. The railroad created land improvement companies designed to provide luxury resorts and plan small towns. Within a few years, the rail lines would stretch from Spokane to Coeur d'Alene and Hayden Lakes to the east, with another line heading south through the Palouse, splitting at Spring Valley to continue on to Colfax and Moscow. To understand the development of this railroad, it is important to understand the men involved and the influence they had on the region. J.P. Graves, described as a mining man, a railroad man, a real estate man, and a catalyst for other builders, came to Spokane in 1887. By 1901, he had made his first fortune with the Granby Smelter at Grand Forks, British Columbia, the largest copper plant in the British Empire. In the process, he worked with two of the major railroad entrepreneurs in the area, James J. Hill of the Great Northern and D.C. Corbin of the Canadian Pacific Railway. Graves had discussed his plans for Granby with his wife and their boarder, Aubrey White. White became a major investor in Granby as well as other business ventures, including Graves Railroad. In the process, the two formed a friendship that would last decades. In 1902, Graves was listed in the Blue Book of Spokane, which included the most successful and recognized members of society. These members included professional people, land speculators, merchants and mining or lumber magnates, who all knew each other because they traveled in the same social circles. They met in exclusive clubs, the Spokane, the university, and the country. They directed businesses and banks, patronized theaters, summered at Coeur d'Alene, Liberty, and Hayden Lakes, rode and chauffeured automobiles, and relished recognition by the common people. These men also shared a vision of the kind of city Spokane should be. They believed a city could be beautiful as well as utilitarian, a movement made popular nationwide at the World Exposition of 1893 in Chicago. This vision included artistic public buildings, monuments, parks, vistas, and tree-lined avenues. After more than 24 blocks of Spokane's downtown area burned in the fire of 1889, these men saw their chance to rebuild the city in their vision, this time mainly in brick and granite. As businesses prospered, the population of Spokane was growing quickly, and housing was always in short supply. Better quality housing was in demand, and land speculation was at an all-time high. An opportunity had presented itself, and Graves and the others took it. In 1902, Graves purchased the Spokane and Montrose Electric Motor Railroad, a small streetcar line which consisted of 3 1/8 miles of track and 4 cars. It had originally been built by Francis Cook to promote his extensive real estate holdings in the southeastern part of the city. Cook had lost both the streetcar company and the land in the Panic of 1893. Although Graves had originally purchased the company as a business investment for his son Clyde, he immediately saw its potential as a way to develop real estate, as was being done all over the country. The development pattern of urban cores and of the nearby suburbs was shaped during that period. It was a pattern of moderately high densities compactly arranged within walking distance of the streetcar lines. He reorganized the company as the Spokane Traction Company in early 1903 and converted the street railway from narrow to standard gauge. The incorporators were Clyde M. Graves, J.P. Graves, Fred B. Grinnell, Charles Reeder, and A.L. White. The corporation was capitalized at $500,000 to be in the form of 5,000 shares valued at $100 each and was incorporated for a period of 50 years. With other landowners in the area, including Washington Water Power, the Hypothec Bank, and the real estate developer Frank Hogan, Graves offered more than 80 acres to the city for a new park. The city agreed to build a gracious drive up to the land, provide upkeep for the park, and named it for the Nez Perce word for high ground, Manitou. By 1908, the new park included playfields, picnic area, zoo, gardens, pond, and paths, and it would become a favorite destination of many riders on Traction Company cars. Now Graves began selling his home sites, starting at $200 apiece, with those overlooking the park going for as much as $1,000 each. He organized the Spokane, Washington Improvement Company with wide powers to lay out additions to Spokane, install water systems, grade streets, establish and maintain parks, and so on. He hired Fred Grinnell as his land agent, and the two began planting trees along the district's main streets. At this same time, Aubrey White returned from a visit to New York City, where he had seen Central Park and met the landscaping architects whose firm had designed it, the Olmsted Brothers of Brookline, Massachusetts. White was adamant that Spokane must replace the standard grid layout for its streets with vistas, curving boulevards, and parks throughout the city. He solicited John Olmsted to stop over in Spokane on his way to Seattle and paid him $50 of his own money for advice on planning parks. Graves and the others saw the potential of a famous name attracting investors and hired Olmsted to plan Manitou Park. While Olmsted was in town, Aubrey White would haul him off to evaluate some remote spot in the city by bumpy automobile or buggy rides, or sometimes struggles on foot through the undergrowth, as Olmsted talked to White about a general plan for Spokane. They would connect the nicest parks by boulevards and parkways, at least 150 feet wide, providing pleasure for both walking and driving. Houses would be set back and trees would be planted along all residential streets. A new series of diagonal avenues would connect different parts of the city, as diagonal routes would shorten travel time and provide streetcar access. Graves knew that streetcar connections were vital to the development of outlying areas, but he was not alone. From the beginning, he had competed with Washington Water Power, WWP, electrical company, and their already established street railway system. In May 1903, Graves received a franchise from the city to build anywhere he chose. The franchise demonstrated the city council's discontent with the Washington Water Power Company, which had purchased and consolidated all the other streetcar routes. WWP had decided that they would not expand their routes, hoping to force land developers to build in areas already being serviced. They complained that power costs would be very high on new lines, which was true. Graves' business success forced them to compete, and soon the two were building all over Spokane. The traction company opened up districts at Manitou and Rockwood, as well as Lincoln Heights, Cannon Hill Park, Corbin Park, and Audubon. Sometimes the two companies would be building lines within blocks of each other. Ironically, Graves bought the power for his railway from his major competitor and would continue to do so over the life of the railway. The two companies competed for everything: new developments, recreational outings, even creating destination points for the streetcar lines. Graves owned a minor league baseball team, which played just north of the fairgrounds. He considered opening an amusement park there to compete with WWP, who owned Natatorium Park on the west side of town. This focus on recreational destination points became Graves' reason for financing his second railroad. Frederick A. Blackwell organized a company to build a railway between Coeur d'Alene and Spokane, less than a month before Graves took control of the Montrose Line. As Blackwell's line reached toward Spokane, he bargained with Graves for passenger access over traction company lines. The two came to an agreement and began raising money together for the new railroad. The Coeur d'Alene and Spokane Railway was opened to traffic in the winter of 1903 and provided a dividend payer from the start. While the two had dreams of making the Coeur d'Alene and Spokane a recreational railway, where Spokane commuters could get away for the weekend in luxury, the first trip was a little more humble. They had to borrow two old open summer cars from Washington Water Power. The sides closed with canvas tarpaulins, a chilly ride. A bottle of warming Old Crow whiskey made its rounds among the adult passengers. When their new cars arrived, Graves and Blackwell showed that they only used the best. The J.G. Brill Company of Philadelphia was known for its well-made and beautifully equipped cars, outfitted with Westinghouse traction motors. Not only were these the latest in technology, the interiors were finished in quartered oak, with headlining of 3-ply oak veneer. The windows were glazed with art glass and had stationary upper sashes giving them a waterproof seal. The seats used in all the cars had oak armrests, adjustable footrests, and cushioned seats. Most impressive, the parlor cars had an interior finish of vermilion wood, and the full Empire ceilings were tinted Nile green. Parquet floors were covered with rugs. Interlocking tiles were laid on the 7-foot observation platforms. The Coeur d'Alene line left Spokane with scheduled stops in Greenacre, Spokane Bridge, Post Falls, Hewitter, and Gibbs. The distance was 32.5 miles and took approximately an hour and 15 minutes. When the cars reached Coeur d'Alene, they connected with the Red Collar steamship line, which offered boat services to St. Marie's, Rockford Bay, Mica Bay, and Harrison. There was also a direct connection between the depot in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, the Shoshone Flyer, or Train 8, which took only an hour. This train connected with the Red Collar steamers, where passengers could cruise around the lake or travel south across the lake to Harrison. The tourist trade proved so profitable, Graves and Blackwell decided to provide a line to Liberty Lake, 17 miles east of Spokane. A 32-acre park, Wicomico, provided dining, dancing, and swimming, as well as boat rentals and concessions. It became so popular, the line built a hotel to accommodate visitors who wished to spend the night. 12 lines were running a day with stops in Del Norte, Millwood, and Greenacres, the entire trip taking only 35 minutes. In 1906, the line was extended to Hayden Lake, just 8 miles north of Coeur d'Alene, where the company built one of the finest resort complexes in the entire Pacific Northwest. The Hayden Lake Improvement Company was created with Aubrey White as president. The company hired a son of the Olmsted brothers, F.L. Olmsted Jr., to build the 158-acre grounds. The new resort featured a 9-hole golf course, boating and bathing facilities, 4 tennis courts, and hiking trails. The centerpiece was the Bazanta Tavern, a Swiss chalet-style building designed by the renowned Spokane architect Kirtland Cutter. The resort became so popular that many wealthy Spokane families, including Graves and White, built summer homes there. A visit by President William Howard Taft in 1907 confirmed the resort's upper-class status. The Hayden Lake Improvement Company promoted their green city in the pines by mailing attractive brochures out to the public with fresh pine needles to carry the balsa of the forest direct to the recipient. They used expensive paper and professional photographers for their brochures and bragged that unlike cheaper versions from other companies, no one would see one of our folders discarded on the floor of our cars or depots. On December 13, 1904, Graves organized the Spokane and Inland Railway Company with the purpose of building railways and electrical generating plants in both Washington and Idaho. This new company absorbed the Coeur d'Alene and Spokane Railway and created a new board of directors. These included real estate mogul Lewis Clark, Frederick Blackwell, Alfred Coolidge, president of Traders National Bank in Spokane, and Jay's brother, Will Graves. Coolidge and his partner, A. Fielding McLean, owned lands and banks in the Palouse, indicating that the company could literally be going in a new direction. Graves received 3 loans from Traders Bank of $50,000 for the Spokane and Inland, $25,000 for the Spokane Traction Company, and an additional $50,000 for the new Spokane Terminal Company. The Terminal Company was formed in early 1905 with the purpose of acquiring passenger and freight terminals, gaining right-of-way access to the city of Spokane, acquiring freight yards and grounds for machine shops and car barns. A joint shop complex to be shared by the two companies was also planned near the Spokane River east of Division Street. The company's new passenger terminal, the Interurban Depot, was completed in early 1906 at the corner of Main and Lincoln. At a price of $110,000, Graves insisted on the highest quality, as always, using golden oak and local marble for the interior. The first floor was a combination of union ticket offices, passenger, baggage, and express rooms, while the upper 2 floors were designated as offices for Graves and his associates. In October 1905, Blackwell and Graves returned from a trip back east, where they were seeking financial support for a new electric railroad into the Palouse. Investment bankers E.H. Rowlands and Sons of Boston, as well as Peabody, Hoftelling and Company of Chicago, decided to send railroad expert George W. Ristin to Spokane to evaluate Graves' proposal. Ristin approved the route, which would follow valleys southeast from Spokane to Waverly, and then veer almost directly south, emerging from piney scablands into the unique dunes of the Palouse country. At Spring Valley, a town the railroad planned to create as a junction point, the lines would split with one traveling south to Colfax, while the other followed a southeast route to Moscow. When Graves and Blackwell returned from their trip, they asked for financial support for their new railroad from the people in the area, saying that if adequate stock was purchased, the electric line would be built through the heart of the Palouse. A Spokane Chamber of Commerce subscription campaign, headed by David T. Hamm, the owner of Liberty Lakes Wicomico Resort, raised almost $200,000. Graves decided it was enough to begin, and contracted with Porter Brothers of Spokane to build the first section of the new railroad, the 22 miles to Waverly. This was chosen as the first destination point because fellow railroad man D.C. Corbin was developing a sugar beet factory there. However, Graves was confident enough in the future of his new railroad that he bought enough ties to reach all the way to Moscow. The Spokane and Inland would be in competition with the Union Pacific and Northern Pacific, but many Palouse residents complained the other railroads were not providing them with adequate service. The NP hugs too close to the mountains to reach the whole country. Colfax is too far distant to ship over any branch of the NP and is at the mercy of the Union Pacific. Graves planned to compete in existing towns for passengers, as well as stopping in towns not currently served by the other railroads. He realized that it would make sense to develop the rural areas along his new railroad. Graves, who fancied himself a gentleman farmer, believed many Spokane residents would prefer to settle in the country if commuting to town were convenient. Graves planned to offer frequent service to the Palouse, allowing rural patrons an easy trip for business or pleasure. The Palouse is an area of fertile rolling hills, widely known for its wheat production, but sparsely populated. As one passenger commented, "No other equal area in the world has such rich soil and has made so many rich men, yet at the same time support so small a population per square mile as Whitman County." Graves hoped to change that by building up new towns, beginning with Valley Forge. Located 16 miles southeast of Spokane, Valley Forge grew from rocks and pines into one of the prettiest places found anywhere along the railroad. Described as a garden spot by the company's promoters, the area was well known for its loose, sub-irrigated loam that produced large crops of fruits, vegetables, and grains. The town grew quickly with the railroad's support, which included grading streets, laying sidewalks, and installing modern conveniences like the public water system. Within a few years, there was a general store, hotel, bakery, candy store, service station, post office, bank, attorney's office, community hall, grain and fruit warehouses, and a new school system, all centered on a small farm belt dotted with fruit orchards.